The first drink I ever had was like a spiritual experience because I absolutely hated myself and was really, really thought I was ugly. I had bad spots. I was, you know, I put on this brave face. I didn't give a shit about anything. Excuse my language. And I had this drink and suddenly I felt amazing. I felt love for myself. I felt, I don't care what people think about me. Yeah. And I was into martial arts and the Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. So me and my mate were trying to do Jackie Chan off our heads. Just, and it was the best thing in my life. And I was like, that, I'm doing that again.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scofield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest today is Alistair Richardson. With 23 years of long-term recovery from addiction and codependency, Alistair not only brings deep professional expertise, but personal insight and compassion to his work. He shares about the truths about love addiction, and this might surprise you, healing the matrix, which literally blew my mind, the pure central self, and how you can heal yourself at any age, at any stage of your life. Alistair runs a thriving private practice, Life Force Trauma Healing Limited, offering one-to-one therapy, trauma healing, and intensive transformation groups. Alistair's mission is to help others reclaim their lives with confidence and clarity. I hope this conversation opens your mind and leaves you feeling full of love, full of light and joy, as it did for me. Alistair, thank you so much for coming on. This is powerful. I'm really looking forward to this. You're dedicated to helping individuals who overcome profound effects of trauma, including childhood trauma, codependency and a wide range of addictions, as well as spiritual blocks, which I'd love to get into later.
Okay.
I'd love to know about you, Alistair, where you're from and how your upbringing was.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks for welcoming me on this podcast. It's an amazing opportunity to spread a blessing to people, you know. So my childhood, I had quite a fair amount of trauma. You know, my dad ran off with the au pair when I was four. My mum was one of us, but she was a functional addict, you know, she was very successful, but she was unskillful, you know, my parents did the best they could with their history, their problems, their belief system, you know, and I think I said to you yesterday, I don't see myself as a victim of my trauma, because I think on a spiritual level, I chose it to prepare me for this work that I do, you know, but saying that, it did harm me in my childhood, you know. So, for example, when I was about three, my dad was late home and I was saying to mum, can I stay up? And she said, no, go to bed. And I had a tantrum and I said, oh, well, I'm going to kill myself then. And she goes, well, go on then. And I was like, huh? And then I'm going to throw myself in quicksand, go on then. So she kept saying, go on then, whenever I said I was going to kill myself. And I said, I'm going to throw myself out the window. She said, go on then. So I literally climbed on the window to jump out from the first floor when I was three or four. And I thought then, bad idea, I'm going to hurt myself. So I didn't. But I took on a belief at that time, maybe that my mum didn't want me to live. And when I was about six, she took me to the morgue to see a dead boy my age. She was a doctor and she never explained why. I know now she was really frightened I was going to die because I would do really dangerous things. You know, I'd climb on roofs and, you know, because I think after my dad left, it was that I learned to do dangerous things to fix my feelings, to escape into fantasy. And then she took me to boarding school when I was seven, but she didn't tell me she was going to leave me there. You know, she said, come and see this school, see if you like it. If you like it, you can stay. And we went to the school, had a look round. I was fully expecting to come home. She says, do you like it? I said, yeah, but I don't want to stay. She says, well, you are staying and your bag's packed. And she just left me there. And I, at that moment, I didn't even know this till years later. That was the most traumatic part of that memory, when she told me, because she was the last person I trusted in the world at that point. And she just betrayed me and abandoned me, you know. So lots of beliefs like I'm worthless. My mum used to say to me, if you live to the age of 18, I'm going to treat myself to a meal in the Savoy Hotel. So there's lots of messages about death and stuff, you know.
Which you take on as a child, right? And parents might not understand that you're taking it on.
Absolutely.
But not understanding the bigger picture.
Yeah, and I was heartbroken. And my dad visited first and I told him I've decided not to kill myself yet. So I learned to push all that down. I hated myself. But I couldn't afford to be feeling that stuff because I think I was fighting for my life in a way. So I just learned to, I escaped into a fantasy world. I used to pretend I'd been kidnapped and did this little role play thing in the toilets by myself. You know, I'd wake up, I'd close my eyes and go, oh, where am I? I must have been kidnapped. I don't remember being brought here. You know, and then I was trying to be a superhero like the Black Panther back then was my favorite because you could kind of almost be the Black Panther. You can't be Superman, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It wouldn't be, you'd get kind of noticed a little bit running around with a cape.
And pants on the outside. Also trying to fly, don't you?
Do you know, it's really funny. When you said about the morgue, my dad took me to, he actually, his last workplace was the director of a funeral service. And he took me because I was driving really fast in my car though. I was about 17, I think at the time. And he said, you need to come see this. And in a way, I was like, okay, fine, I'll come along. And there was a big accident with some young teenagers in a van, and they all died. And some of them was very damaged. And when I saw that, that was a bit... I kind of braved it out because I wanted... My dad's old school Victorian, and he's very steely. And I remember saying, oh, yeah, okay. And I saw the bodies and saw that and was told what happened and stuff and got back in the car with my dad and started to drive home and I thought I was okay, but on the way home I started to retch.
Then
it really played on my mind for for quite some time. But he did explain why he was doing it.
Yeah, and as a
it's
kid,
a different yeah. It's a, and I was older, so it's a different thing.
Because as a kid, isn't it, especially younger, you blame yourself for everything because of your brain development.
Yeah.
And you make up, you know, the meaning you make up, you know, my mum doesn't want me to live, you know, so I was in a fight then. And I became very naughty, breaking all the rules.
Yeah.
But before that, I was so heartbroken. I used to cry myself to sleep every night and I'd fantasize. I was totally alone in the world. Everyone who loved me was dead, you know, and so I had to kind of push all that down to survive emotionally. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because my, I had a couple of instances when I was younger, about seven. My grandma died, and she was my favourite grandma. I still can't remember stuff. And I used to get taken there every Saturday morning. I'd jump in bed with her, sleep for a couple of hours, get up, have breakfast, and spend the whole morning with her. And then one day, my dad came in and said, "Oh, your nan's dead," and just went off to make a cup of tea. And completely blew my mind. I didn't know what to say. There was no discussion around it or anything like that. It was just his way of doing things. But the shock or maybe the trauma of that, I can't remember anything. And I find it really weird because my oldest is seven and we've had amazing times together. But it would be strange not to remember. So I think that's some form of trauma. You know?
Absolutely. And when your parents are shut off from their emotions and they abandon your emotion, even if you're with them all the time, which I've learned as a therapist, you know. So, yeah, so there was a bit about my childhood. I got bullied by the teachers at that school. And then my second boarding school, I got really badly bullied for the first year or so until I got big enough to...
How long did you go through the whole boarding school system?
From before? 7 till 16.
That's a long time.
It is. And once someone asked me to prepare like a trauma healing workshop for people who've been to boarding school. And I read this book about boarding school syndrome and boarding school survivors.
Yeah.
And they talk about the A, B, C, D, you know, abandonment, bereavement. Of course, you got no support emotionally. C's for captivity because you can't escape, and D's for dissociation. So people, it doesn't happen to everyone, but people learn to dissociate to cope.
Yeah, you know, but it's a real thing. I mean, I've spoken to lots of people who've been to boarding school who've experienced the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember reading this book, and they say going to boarding school is a bit like being sent to a care home, but your parents actually want to send you. Normally when you get sent to a care home, it's like a gilded care home, you know, like a posh care home with lots of facilities, but there's no parental love there for you. And you know that your parents want to send you. So any sort of abuse you get there, as a kid, I thought, well, my mum must want me to experience this, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
That has to be horrific as a child.
It was, but I couldn't let myself feel it, you know. Yeah. So,
you know, it's funny, my father went, he got taken away a few times, and he went to, last time I think he said he was 12 or 13, but he was undernourished, very undercared for, to say the least. And he said he was the only one on the bus smiling and waving because he couldn't wait to get away. And he had a really good time where he went because the guy who run the facility was a genuine kind human being and looked after him and stuff like that. So he'd experienced the opposite from his childhood.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm one of the people who would never send my kids to boarding school in a million years.
No, I would not. That's fair enough. What? So when you left, Alistair, was that kind of a celebration that you'd left boarding school? Or?
Well, I left under a cloud because I was asked to leave, you know, like 2 weeks before the end of term. But I actually changed my mind and decided I wanted to stay. And they said, no, you're leaving. You know, was it a celebration? I don't know, but I was drinking by then, and mainly drinking was the first drug I took.
Yeah.
And I was just drinking loads and partying. And
Was there a lot of that where you were in the boarding school?
Well, I know what I did, because me and my best mate used to go out. I don't know what the other people did in a way, because we'd sneak out on the weekends and go and get drunk. But the first drink I ever had, and I want to know about your experience as well, was like a spiritual experience. Because I absolutely hated myself and was really, really thought I was ugly. I had bad spots. I was, you know, I put on this brave face. I didn't give a shit about anything. Excuse my language.
Welcome.
And I had this drink and suddenly I felt amazing. I felt love for myself. I felt, I don't care what people think about me. Yeah. And I was into martial arts and the Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. So me and my mate were trying to do Jackie Chan off our heads. Just, and it was the best thing in my life. And I was like, that, I'm doing that again. And I immediately turn my life into trying to get off my head.
Yeah.
You know?
Which makes total sense. It makes total sense. If you felt pain, adversity and loss and abandonment, all those things all that time, it's like a magic potion, isn't it? Not
absolutely.
Not that we're selling it, but it can have that effect on people immediately.
Yeah. And what was yours like, your first?
Apparently when I was four, I'd just finished off the wine at the table. And was rolling around the floor, calling people silly names like Bugs Bunny or whatever. And they wondered what on earth happened and realised I'd drunk it and put me to bed. I have no memory of that because I was too young. Then I tried to drink Guinness with my grandfather just because I wanted to sit with him and be like this stoic guy. And it was awful. I didn't want to drink because I saw what it done to family members, and I'd seen... We had quite a party house in our street, which was had a plus side. It was nice, but I saw lots of fights, violence, and just a very intimidating, manipulative behaviour, which I really didn't like. Like I really, really didn't like. And there was a few things that happened as a child that just was deep betrayal, like growing up saying certain things and acting the opposite. Doing the complete opposite of what they were saying they are, and then it was very, very weird, and so I didn't want to drink. I just thought this liquid, see what it done with people that I admired, turn into this either a bawling mess or very angry, and I really didn't like it, but I wanted to belong.
Yeah,
and I remember fake drinking at 13 as if I was drinking with the boys, drinking scotch. I was just sipping it, but wasn't drinking it, and it was pure fear. To be honest. But when I was 15, we went on our first holiday to Mallorca, and and I had to fit in with the boys. A lot of the guys out of London came with their families. About 30 of us went. And I just remember going to the bar to order it and feeling a bit, we was all smoking and stuff, feeling a bit like what I felt was mature, taking a bit of power back.
Yeah.
And I just got violently sick. I don't remember anything after the first few drinks. I have no idea where we went, what we did. I just remember waking up in the morning feeling like I'd been poisoned and saying to myself, I'm never doing that again, ever. Which lasted a short period of time. but I must say, a couple of years later, because I was training as a boxer at the time and I was really into my fitness, and that was escape for me when I look back, because I used to train obsessively. Thinking about it last night, I had about 3% body fat by the age of 15 because I was just, I'd go and run 5 miles, I'd come back and do press-ups. I was just obsessively trained because I felt like that there was no one around me to look after me, so I needed to look after myself. Yeah. And that's why I was obsessed, not for anyone else, but just for me. I needed to be able to run somewhere.
Sure.
Far and fast.
Yeah.
You know.
That belief, I can't trust anyone and no one's going to help me if I ask them for help. You know, I had that as well. So,
yeah.
You know, so you don't ask for help, do you?
No, you don't. Can see how it's pushed a lot of people away.
Sure.
And probably I've avoided certain situations which maybe weren't as bad as I portrayed them to be, but it was all self-protection, you know. And but I do remember later on feeling the relief from alcohol.
Mm.
And actually that exhale of, oh, I can relax, and then feeling funny. Only for the first few, because it would turn a bit, you know, it got dark as well for me. But the first few drinks, I always tried to find that balance of just not feeling myself, feeling freer with my thinking, just a bit funnier, jovial. And like you said, you know, you feel taller, more handsome. You don't care what you say if you say something wrong. So I liked that, that space, but never could stay there.
No, because there's always, you know, have another one, feel even more like that. That's what I was like anyway.
Yeah, completely, yeah. I had a phobia of being sick.
Ah.
So I would always try to have some water or line my stomach. My mum would be like, if you're going out, line your stomach with milk or have some bread, you know, that kind of thing, which is weird, really. It's like,
yeah,
prepare yourself to go into battle. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so you started drinking then. You wanted to stay on, but then they said for you to leave.
To leave, yeah.
So what happened?
Well, then I went to Ashford. I was a punk in this posh boarding school. I was like, I was this snob against the snobs, you know, because they looked down on the cleaning staff and called them proles and all this like proletariat. Right. So I was like looking down on them, you know.
Yeah.
And I left and I went to Ashford College in Kent in my punk gear and my Mohican and all this stuff. And just used to part, you know, I used to steal alcohol twice a week with my mates from the local supermarket and, you know, like a half bottle of vodka or something and get hammered. And just loved it, really, and started smoking. I'd always been anti-smoking because I was a county squash player until I got to drinking, do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I was really anti-smoking, but someone said to me in a pub, if you inhale it for like 10 seconds and hold your breath for a minute, it gives you a real buzz. And that's how I started smoking, because it gave me a buzz when I was drinking. And then he says, try it when you're sober. It works when you're sober. And I did it, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm off my head a bit, you know. So that got me going.
Yeah.
But my mum started telling me I was an alcoholic, you see. So that's the first. And to me, it was the best thing in my life. I loved it. So I was really angry and I used to try and prove I wasn't, you know.
Yeah. How comes you went to college then? What did you study?
I did a year of college, which was sociology and psychology. I just think it was drilled into me because I come from an academic family. My mum was a doctor. My dad was a doctor, you know, like, do you go do a degree, all this stuff, you know. And I didn't want to go to work. But after a year at college, I thought, I'm going to leave. And I went to the world of work. But I was so arrogant that I kept getting the sack. Because I thought, just because you're my boss doesn't give you permission to tell me what to do, you know, or give you respect unless you earn it. And I kept getting sacked. So I thought, I'll go back to college.
There's a pattern here. And where did you go back and study?
Philosophy and sociology. Okay. And I did that in a year. And then I did a social sciences degree. Was my first degree in London. But before that, I got arrested for stealing alcohol. after I had one. For people who don't know much about addiction, once you have one, you can't control how much you have, or you can't guarantee how much you're going to have, isn't it? So I had one or two one day, and I went and tried to rob the local supermarket, and I broke my way of doing it that would have not got me in trouble because I was so desperate. And I was in the local paper, student thief must tackle alcoholism. You know, and I thought, I know what, I'll pretend I'm an alcoholic, go to a 12-step fellowship and not drink for all this time, and then get off the court case, you know, which is what I did. And then I went to get hammered to celebrate, of course, you know.
How was that going in undercover as a, just trying to get out of your case? Was it weird to go into AA?
I listened and I thought, well, I'm a bit like you guys and girls, you know, when I have one, I can't guarantee what's going to happen, but I can sometimes. But I didn't hit. So that's all I heard. If it's causing you problems, it's a problem. So I thought, well, it is causing me problems, but I'm not as bad as any of you. Yeah. I didn't know the thing about denial. Don't even notice I'm lying, that the addict's mind will, I'll lie to myself, you know, about how bad it is. So, and I didn't hear the bit about the mental obsession, that I'll always go back to it, even if I don't want to, if I've got an addiction.
Yeah.
So I kind of, but it did spoil my drinking, actually. Well, no, I got sent to a treatment center on the back of that for a while and left after 3 days. But that spoiled my drinking and using, because I was always thinking, am I an addict? Yeah. You know what I mean?
When did you finally give up drinking after that point?
Well, I gave up first when I was at uni, when I was about 20, for 6 years, because my mum stopped paying. She said, you've got to go to a 12-step fellowship and do the steps and stop smoking dope, as in hash. And I did it for a year, and then I started taking, you know, then I read that Bill W., who founded AA, took hallucinogenics, yeah. And I never had them. And I thought, well, if he did that, then surely I can. And I read all these Carlos Castaneda books about spiritual awakening through hallucinogenics and stuff like that. And I knew I had to have a spiritual awakening, which is the message of the 12 steps, isn't it? But I wasn't going to do it the way my mum told me to do it, because she told me to go and do the 12 steps. So I tried every way. But I started taking speed occasionally, addicted to cannabis instead, and did all these other spiritual stuff to try and fix myself, basically. And I was addicted to, if I met a woman into a relationship, she would be my drug, and I'd put her on a pedestal and I'd be love addicted. And I didn't realize I was trying to heal that abandoned little boy in me through that woman's love, you know?
Yeah. How do you describe what addiction is, Alistair? Because a lot of people have different views. And before I came into a 12-step program, I just thought it was someone who was weak-willed, who, you know, just didn't want to belong to life, or was. I had no idea about, you know, changing the way you feel for a substance or alcohol, and also the obsession of the mind.
I keep it simple. It's something you can't beat by yourself, you know, is one thing I say to people. You know, there's lots of definitions of addiction. It's continued use despite adverse circumstances. It's a pathological or destructive relationship with a chemical or a mood altering behavior or relationship. I think it's also a spiritual search in a way. You know, like I said, when I had that first drink, I had a spiritual experience. I do believe, like a guy called David Hawkins says, I connected with a higher power. Because it pushed down, it suppressed all the negative stuff and all the trauma for a while. And I had this really amazing feeling, and I was willing to die for it potentially to get that back.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I remember thinking about that as well, like why I used and what was I trying to get? And initially I was definitely, first I was trying to belong, that's for sure. Then after I got dependent, I was trying to just take away my thought process to make myself feel better so I could function. But there was definitely, and we've never spoke about this on the podcast yet, so I'm glad you brought it up, about the spiritual side. You know, a lot of people I speak to in recovery have always wanted to find something bigger. And for me, when I used to use or drink, it would take away the obsessive thought process about myself and about life and what people have done, what they haven't done, and what do I do next, and how do I do things. And it would bring a peace around. And that peace was the thing I've been searching for a long time, which I found in meditation and different practices even better than I did by using that.
Yeah.
But what do you think about the spiritual side?
Well, I think You know, there's this whole debate, is addiction a disease and everything. And in a way, it doesn't matter as long as, you know, whatever you believe, as long as it helps you get the help you need and transform your life, it doesn't really matter what you call it. But I think, in a way, I chose to have an addiction because it was going to force me to connect spiritually to a higher power and to be a blessing in this world, which is what I'm here to be, yeah. You know? So yeah, I definitely think, I mean, Carl Jung said it's a low level spiritual search, you know, just yeah. If you stick with the booze or the addiction. But yeah, that's the hole in the soul people talk about, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that peace, that joy, that being in the here and now, that's what I've had as well. And, you know, free from addiction through meditation, through even focusing, you know, like carrying the message of recovery or helping people, connecting me with that.
Do you think there's a difference between someone who's done deep searching or practices to find or to be healed with spirits and bring their spirituality around than someone who's agnostic?
There is a difference because, you know, it's the different meaning that people give on it. I do think we are spiritual beings in a human body. And one of the things I do called attunement is to help people come into harmony with their spirit. So, of course, there's a, and it's not a belief, it's an experience for me. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So I think there is a difference, but I don't think it's better necessarily or anything like that. You can have a really good recovery and be an atheist or agnostic, heal your relationship with yourself, be of service and a blessing in the world. And of course, you're going to be to help people. If you're an agnostic or an atheist, you're going to be to help those people
yeah.
who are agnostic or atheists better.
Yeah, well put. It's nice because I think there's wiggle room and space for every type of person in recovery, isn't there?
Yeah.
Is there a difference between someone who's an alcoholic mostly or an addict in the way they have to recover?
I don't think so, because if when I worked at Promise originally, there was this cross addiction questionnaire that everyone would do, and it looks at like addictive relationships, dominant or submissive, compulsive, helping, dominant or submissive, prescription drugs, exercise, sex. You know, there's a few of the things on there. Every alcoholic has got other addictions, in my opinion, what I've seen, you know. Yeah. And underneath that is the codependency often, which is a dysfunctional relationship with self and others. Because of what we learned growing up, because of dysfunctional parenting or abuse or whatever you want to, or trauma, whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, yes, you can get into recovery from one drug and you might be using in a functional way other addictions. Oh, well, I'm free from alcohol. You know, I was free from alcohol for 6 years, that I told you, but I was taking yeah. other drugs and addicted to my wife to be my first wife, you know. So, yeah, I look at the whole person and, you know, and I've had to look at different things in me, different addictive processes as well.
Yeah. I was just in Ibiza last summer and I'd met a couple who in Italy a little while before. And I still get a bit of social anxiety and was at a table with people we hadn't met and we was talking and I noticed the guy wasn't drinking and I said, oh, do you not drink? And he said, no. I said, I haven't drunk for 3 years. I was like, oh, great. Are you sober? And he's like, yeah. My wife's sober 15 years. I was like, okay. So we spoke and stuff. And then when I was in Ibiza, where they live, they invited us to a party in their house and we went to the party. And it was a very boozy party place in Ibiza. And there was lots of trays of mushrooms and different psilocybin chocolates.
Magic mushrooms, right, yeah.
Yeah, loads and loads and loads and loads of stuff. So I said, I thought you were sober. And they said, no, we're Ibiza sober. But sincerely, and I was like, oh, what's that then? So it's like kind of like we touched on before, that's okay because it's medicinal.
It's a teacher plant and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think there's a real difference between, and we had Professor David Nutt on and talking about the benefits of psilocybin and stuff encompassed with treatment. And I know a few people that are just microdosing themselves permanently. But I found it interesting, this break off, this new sobriety, where as long as you don't touch alcohol or hard drugs, that you're allowed to do that. But I feel like it's a bit of a, personally, a bit of a scapegoat a bit of, are you still getting something?
Yeah, I don't know about microdosing because I don't know if that's a mood altering at all. But I know I heard this saying once, you know, like, because I had a spiritual experience taking mushrooms one time where literally I was walking along and I felt a tug on me on Wimbledon Common. And I looked down and it was a mushroom growing on in the ground. And I was like, huh? And I walked on, I felt another tug on me, looked down, there was a mushroom. And I thought, and it became a game. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had called on the mushroom spirits to guide me. I was in that Carlos Castaneda phase. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got back to the flats I lived in and I felt another tug on me, which I hadn't had for ages. And I looked down and there's this little mushroom there. And I thought, I know what, I'm going to go down in the morning and check, is there a mushroom or am I just completely going bonkers here? In the morning, I went down and it took me about 20 seconds to see this little mushroom there. So I had this spiritual experience, expanded awareness through hallucinogenics. But after that, it was gone again. And someone said, it's like going to the top of the mountain by a helicopter. You get the view and then you drop back down.
Interesting.
But yeah, I wouldn't do any of that stuff for me because I would do, you know, I'm addictive enough without drugs and alcohol.
don't have to sell me anything. I saw an incredible fifth generation Cherokee Indian woman in LA. And we did this whole ceremony where we bring cherry tobacco to the elders and she does this whole process. And it was... It's hard to explain the experience to people if they listen. It sounds a bit woo-woo, but it was incredible because she took me back and I saw, felt and smelt different times of when I'd been here in different bodies over the period. And
different lives sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And actually saw
those
processes. And she told me at one point where I was killed as a young Cherokee Indian and where it was and stuff. And did I want to go through the process to become a man? She took me through the whole process and it honestly is hard to explain unless you've been there, but it was more powerful than taking mushrooms and acid, which I had done early on in my life.
Mm.
It was unbelievable. And and a year later, I was with a friend of mine who bought a house in upstate New York and he's like, come out to the lake house. We went out there with a friend of mine and we walked around the lake, sat down to look at the view and it was incredible. And I had an experience where I switched back into that time just for a few minutes and come back. And it was, you know, it sounds nuts to people, that's fine. But to have that experience in reality, literally like in Sunday afternoon, was unbelievable for me. And I found out when I phoned the Cherokee Indian woman back, that was the place where I was supposed to have been killed as a kid. So it's very odd.
I've had some past life things. And whether you believe it or not, you know, it doesn't matter in a way, whether it's the collective unconscious or, you know, there's lots of explanations. I do believe in past lives though. And some of the healing I've done on me and done with other people is past life linked.
How do you, because you do tapping as well, don't you?
Mm.
Tapping, what is tapping?
Well, it's like acupressure for the emotions and you can learn to do it on yourself. You know, I'm doing it now. Don't know where the camera is. And the most famous one is called the Emotional Freedom Technique. And you can use it to heal trauma from the past, to clear anxiety about future things. When we do a negative prediction of the future, to help dismantle negative beliefs, like I'm weak, I'm worthless, I'm this, I'm that, whatever, or I can't trust anyone, and to help you attain goals. Because when you say a goal, like I will run a marathon within 6 months, in my head a voice says, yeah, right, mate, you know. So you can aim it at that, those things to help you attain your goals. But then, that's just scratching the surface, really. So I train people in EFT and I use it. Well, I now do something called intention tapping.
Okay.
Which uses the power of the unconscious mind or the higher self, whatever you want to call it as well, which is awesome, which is what you might do with me. Yeah, so that's a bit about tapping for people who don't know. And it's been proved scientifically to reduce cortisol in the saliva by 37%, you know, things like that.
Is it because what you say to yourself at the time or because you're tapping acupressure points, that is it a combination of them both which works?
It is, but you could... With the intention statements, it is saying what you say as well, but you can tap without saying anything and it works.
Definitely coming.
So if you're anxious in your chest, you can just focus on that and tap. Okay. And it doesn't work for everyone. Nothing works for everyone. you know, but it will often then reduce or change to something else, and you just keep tapping. It's called simple energy techniques, that one.
Okay.
Which is part of intention tapping. So
your expertise also includes matrix re-imprinting. What is that? How does that work?
Well, the guy who developed that, called Carl Dawson, he was helping someone with the emotional freedom technique one time, and this person got, when people have a trauma reaction, they often, if it's unhealed in any way, they often feel like they're back in the memory, looking through the eyes of their younger self, like, oh my God, I'm seeing it happening, and they feel all the feelings. So this started happening, and or something like that, and he got this woman to step out of the younger self and said, well, why don't you tap on your younger self? So you go into memories and help your younger self. So it's like, you know, inner child work, but you bring tapping in as well. But then it's about what belief did you take on at the time? Because when we have a trauma, we take on a belief about ourselves, other people in the world. And then, especially if we're old enough to think, yeah? And then we have that belief. Like, I had that belief, I'm worthless, I'm bad, people will leave me if they love me from my boarding school stuff. So then my subconscious mind is always looking out for people who are going to abandon me to protect myself.
Yeah.
And my conscious mind. So I'm going to find evidence for what I believe, which makes the belief stronger. And in the end, I'll attract in experiences that reinforce my belief. So that's why it gets worse and worse and worse. So matrix re-imprinting, you go in to the memory in a safe way to help your younger traumatized self. You clear their trauma with the tapping. You can bring in healing for them. But you can even, I want to give an example. I worked with someone recently whose dad was, you know, he never really had a close relationship with his dad. And you can go in and tap on the younger dad and the mum as well. And actually, once the trauma's gone, it's like, well, what would you have wanted from your parents? Oh, I would like them to, I would like to tell them what was going on for me and how their behavior was affecting me. And for them to take ownership and maybe give me a hug. And that all happened. And he just felt so much joy.
Wow.
And then you breathe it in through your whole body to every cell of your body with all the colors, you know, all the senses, then you breathe it into your heart and you beam it out to the universe in all directions. And,
wow.
And then you do it for 21 days. And you're sending out the new energy, the new relationship with yourself, and you've reinforced a new belief as well. But you can go to past lives, you can go to future lives. You can meet a future self who has overcome the problem you're facing and get advice from them. It's awesome.
Wow, that's amazing. What's your passion that keeps you going to help other people?
My passion, well, it's just an inner passion, really. I'm very good at helping other people, much better than helping myself, as the you know, everyone knows. But I'm very good at helping other people, and it's a joy. And I do believe it's, you know, I was in India, I was trying to find enlightenment at one point in my life, but it was an addiction tour, really, it turned into.
What does that mean, an addiction tour?
Well, I ended up acting out my addiction. I got into an addictive relationship. I started drinking and smoking weed again, as well as trying to do spiritual practice. So my addiction was loud and strong in that time.
Yeah.
Where I really learned about love addiction, I must say.
I'd love to touch on that. I was about 8 years of age. We went on a holiday to some holiday camp, and there was a girl who won the beauty competition. She was probably 16 at the time. And she came over and sat and talked to me. And I was like, wow, this girl's amazing. And I remember at that age crying all the way home. My dad was like, what is wrong with this kid? You know, and I had these strong feelings and these strong emotions, but obviously didn't know what they were. And after my first relationship, when that ended, it was so painful. I didn't know what to do with myself. But what I did, it was like, it was such a deep loss.
You see, I had almost exactly the same experience at a holiday camp when I was about 8. It's so funny, man. You know, but it was Beverly, the yellow coat, who I had this kind of
Hey, that was my Beverly.
This obsession with.
Yeah.
And a therapist once said to me, it's because she probably had some really loving mother qualities that you were drawn to. And I wanted my photo taken with her, and I was pestering the guy the whole week, can I have my photo taken? And I cried all the way home. But of course, what I didn't know then, and the same when I had breakups after addictive relationships, is the pain where I felt suicidal or homicidal was the pain of my traumatized younger self. I had merged with my little 7-year-old and even younger, and I thought it was all about that woman. you see, and obsessed with, I've got to get that woman back to fix myself. But actually, it was a healing opportunity, which I didn't know at the time and I didn't take advantage of back then.
I mentor a lot of guys and stuff, and it's a really hard one to explain as a non-therapist what that addiction to the opposite sex is, or to the same sex in a relationship.
If you've been abandoned as a child, and then you've got the belief you're worthless, then you're set up for love addiction often. And if you've been enmeshed, which is another type of abusive or dysfunctional parenting, where the parent uses you to meet their own needs. Like I was told when I was 5, you're the man of the house now by my mom. That was a bit of enmeshment. I've had some enmeshment. That sets people up to be love avoidant, where they feel suffocated if someone gets too close.
Gotcha.
So love addiction, the conscious fear is abandonment, and the unconscious fear is intimacy. Because if you into me see, which I know you know, you're going to leave me because I'm bad and worthless, you know? So I don't really want intimacy if I'm a love addict. And the love avoidance, the mirror opposite, mirror image, like they're frightened of someone coming too close because it triggers their trauma of suffocation and enmeshment. But really, when you get suffocated and enmeshed as a kid, it's abandoning you because your needs aren't being met. So they're also frightened of abandonment. So there's this toxic tango that can happen. Or you can do it with one person.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of people come to you with sex and love addiction?
Yeah, and I mean, I do these trauma healing intent. I call them trauma healing and intent, trauma healing and transformation intensives, rather than trauma weeks or trauma program, for helping people heal from their childhood trauma. And a lot of the people who come are in recovery from addiction, but not necessarily. They're just people who have been having trouble in their relationships with themselves, with their self-esteem, or with other people, because of their childhood stuff that's unresolved. And a lot of them, I do a share about my love addiction and about them. And love avoidance and the model based on Pia Melody, and almost everyone's like, oh my God, that's me. You know, because you can have love addiction with a friend, with a parent, with a child.
How did you have it with a friend?
Well, because my dad left when I was young. When I went to university, I remember I was 19 and I was drinking, so I was fine. Really. I was suppressing all my feelings, but I met this guy called Nick, and he was 28. He was like really brave and strong. He would dive in and rescue someone from 5 people by himself. Yeah. You know, getting beaten up. He was into the occult. He was very confident. I put him on a pedestal, but I didn't know until I stopped drinking. And then when I stopped drinking for a year, around Nick, I started to feel really weird. And it's like, I felt really self-conscious and less than, and I'd be really worried what I said and what he thought about me. And I said to my mate, I said, I don't know what's going on with me and Nick. It's like I fancy him or something. I don't fancy him, but
yeah, but he's on the
pedestal.
Now
I know, I had idealized the loving dad that I didn't have, or the dad, you know, and was...
Interesting.
Yeah, so it can be, or some parents get addicted, love addicted to their children because it's, oh, now I'm whole because you're born and you're so beautiful. Mm. And unfortunately, they're using the child to fix themselves rather than heal themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so I help people heal from that as well.
That's amazing. On your journey of like Eastern stuff and Western stuff, what's the thing that's kind of wowed you the most that works to help heal people?
Do you know what? I mean, the 12-step program for addiction is awesome because I tried everything else I could think of and I needed to do that. So, you know, but that's not therapy. That's something you can go to meetings and do, you know, and you get a support network built in. And if by the way, if you're... Don't be put off by the word God in the steps, because it's a power greater than yourself that you decide what it is, you know. But it's got to be probably the tapping is the best.
Yeah.
But I can't actually pick one because there's something called attunement I do where I've met people where I just feel healed in their presence because they're radiating love and light, you know.
That's what we felt when you walked in.
Thank you. And that's because you know, I was meditating this morning to connect to, I think everyone's got a radiant center. I really want to say this to people. However traumatized you are, however addicted you are, deep down there's a central self that is pure love and unharmed by trauma. And that's why I think I believe that's the truth of everyone. And that's what being in attunement is being connected with that and letting it radiate. Let love radiate without concern for results.
That's really beautiful, because I used to think that a lot of my problems came from the outside. So I'd be cleaning my house and not talking to certain people. But to be really trusting and connecting yourself, I think it's quite a powerful thing, isn't it?
We're doing it now.
Yeah.
By looking, because you can do it through looking as well.
Can you?
Yeah, because if you're in touch with that and you're looking, there's a radiant look where you're looking, letting love radiate out. And then there's a taking look, which is more the addictive look. Well, I need this, or, you know, I need you.
It's funny, yeah, because when you see people come in, or I work with some people, actually, it's a good point. I always say, like, the spiritual side, when someone says, oh, what's this spirituality? And I've seen people come in I've worked with that, you know, when they're in self, they've got that it's almost like a racing driver look, where they're just kind of focused on something that's almost not there, that you can't see.
Mm.
And then that look completely changes. I've also seen, like, the colour of the eyes almost change and get lighter.
Yeah, well, their whole countenance gets lighter, isn't it? And I say, look in the mirror, you're glowing.
Yeah, it's true. And I feel like that's the spirit come back.
Yeah.
You know, I always say, like, when I look at my kids, they're spirited and they're loving and they're present. Mm. And it's kind of like trying to revert back to that look.
Absolutely.
Amazing. We've got a few minutes left.
No, I want it to go longer.
Is there anything you wanted to tell us about, Alistair, or ask me?
Well, I know you said about, you wanted to ask me about working with spiritual blocks earlier.
Yeah.
Kind of talking about that anyway. You know, but helping someone access a power greater than themselves that they decide what it is, you know, I'm good at helping people with that.
When someone's in a vulnerable, desperate place, then you can probably hear that more. But what does that mean, and what's the benefit of having a power greater than yourself?
Well, let me say, there's a system of therapy that's similar to what I do, but I do something slightly different called internal family systems. And the guy who developed that discovered that we've got parts of us, especially if we've been traumatized, who are unhealed. And if you keep saying step back and relax to these parts, step back and relax, you end up coming to the central spiritual self that is connected with the higher power, that is, like I said, is whole, healed, and can do heal it. But the benefit of it, to answer your question, rather than going off passionately.
No, that reminded me of something.
Oh, okay.
Actually.
Shall I go straight to you?
No, we did this thing called, you might have heard of it, called Big Mind, with Paul McKenna when I lived in LA. We used to go to his house or different people's houses on a Sunday morning. And it was similar because he used certain similar phrases about stepping back from yourself. You can relax that part of your mind, whether it's the ego part or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd be transported into this space.
Mm-hmm.
That seem to have no bounds. Is that similar?
Yeah, and that's the central self, or what I'm saying, or that's at the core of everyone, I believe, from my experience, you know.
And that place, we'd stay there for a while, and then it'd bring us back, and it was almost like wiggling back into this body that I didn't want to be in. And that was profound for me. That was probably one of the most freeing experiences I've ever had.
Yeah, so... I mean, in recovery from addiction terms, just getting help is asking for help. You're saying you can't do it by yourself. You know, 10 people can help push a truck up a hill when one person can't. So even if it's the power of other group of people and you're asking them for help, that's a power greater than yourself. So it gives you the power to recover from addiction. You know, so that's the simplest, quickest answer to that. But of course, you know, It's a deep question.
It is a deep question. It's really beautiful talking to you.
You too. We
covered some great stuff that's not been spoken about before.
Good. Well, I prayed beforehand, may it be a blessing to everyone who watches it, you know, and may for you, your Stride company that helps people find support for recovering from addiction. If there's something I can help with someone, you know, we're here.
Thanks, Alistair. I will be, we'll put all the times of your up and coming,
courses or intensives or.
Okay, whatever. We'll put all in there so people can find you, and I will definitely be coming on one.
Well, I look forward to it. I really enjoy meeting you. We've had a couple of phone calls, haven't we? And we've had a good laugh already, so.
Yeah, thanks, Alistair.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate,
follow and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.